Welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark A. Bell. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mike.
We're going to return to atrial fibrillation. The atrial fibrillation ventricular rate is controlled by the conduction properties of the AV node. The typical patient with untreated atrial fib, the ventricular rate can often reach north of 150 beats per minute. There are three reasons that we try to prevent a prolonged, rapid ventricular response in patients with AFib. The first is the avoidance of hemodynamically unstable symptoms. The second is the avoidance of a tachycardia-mediated cardiomyopathy. And the third is that there's some evidence to suggest a mortality benefit from rate control. So we have atrial fibrillation and we have rate control. We have atrial fibrillation, and then we have rhythm control. There are two strategies to manage irregular rhythms. One is the restoration followed by maintenance of the sinus rhythm, and that can occur either with a pharmaceutical therapy or catheter ablation. And the second is rate control with atrioventricular nodal blockers to sort of slow down what's getting through. If you try to control rhythm, you reduce symptoms by decreasing the frequency and duration of episodes, as well as the symptoms during recurrences. Antiarrhythmic drugs are associated with the potential for serious side effects, particularly the induction of proarrhythmias. So in older people at high risk for complications from atrial fibrillation, we're left sort of scratching our head. Do we control rate or do we control rhythm? Well, you found an article. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine, 2020. It starts on page 1305, and it is a competition. For older patients at risk of cardiovascular disease, which is preferred for the recent onset atrial fibrillation? Should we approach this with a strategy of rate control or with a strategy of rhythm control? Mark, who wins?
Yeah, there have been several studies, and most of them have shown no difference in outcomes between rhythm and rate control. A lot of these studies were done, 8 to 10 years ago or so. This study identified 2,800 older adults with an onset of atrial fibrillation within the past year. So new onset, older adults, they'd had a recent TIA or stroke and at least two major cardiac risk factors. At baseline, the average age was 70 years. 12% had a previous TIA or stroke. 44% had valvular heart disease. The groups were balanced at baseline and analysis was by intention to treat. Overall, you know, like I said, this was a very high risk older group of patients. They were then randomized to either rhythm control using a variety of medications or ablation, or to rate control to manage symptoms. In the rhythm control group, recurrent atrial fibrillation triggered additional attempts to cardiovert the patient. In the rhythm control group, after 2 years, about 20% had undergone ablation, about 20% were taking flecainide, about 20% were taking amiodarone or dronedarone, and 35% were taking no antiarrhythmic. In the rate control group, after 2 years, only 7% had undergone ablation and 6% were taking an antiarrhythmic group. The rest were just still on a rate control, rate control strategy. About 90% in both groups were taking anticoagulants after 2 years, which is what you'd want to see. Study was stopped early because they say they found efficacy after a median follow-up of 5 years. So we'll have to judge, you know, there were some benefits, there were some harms. The primary outcome was a composite of two important things, stroke and cardiovascular death, and then two much less important things, hospitalization for heart failure and hospitalization for acute coronary syndrome. You know, if you listen to us, we don't like these kinds of apples and oranges combinations. The composite, you know, of two important things and two less important things was less likely in the rhythm control group. The number needed to treat was 90 over 5 years to prevent one event. With regards to the important outcomes, the likelihoods of cardiovascular death, NNT was 67 over 5 years, and stroke, NNT was 67 over 5 years, was significantly lower in the rhythm control group. hospitalizations for heart failure and acute coronary syndrome were less likely in the rate control group, but this difference wasn't statistically significant. The SF-12, which is a mental health score, was lower in the rhythm control group. Again, they're taking these medications, while patients in that group were significantly more likely to be in sinus rhythm, which you would again hope since they're trying to do rhythm control. Patients in the rhythm control group had significantly more serious adverse events attributable to therapy, things like drug-induced bradycardia, toxicity due to the drugs, pericardial tamponade from ablation procedures, major bleeding. There was no difference in the likelihood of being symptomatic and no difference in hospital days or other health scores. So a lot to unpack, but bottom line, in high-risk older patients with recent onset AFib, a strategy of rhythm control results in fewer cardiovascular deaths and fewer strokes, but it comes at a price of more adverse events, more complications, and a small decrease in health-related quality of life. So this is, you know, like many of these high-stakes decisions, something that needs to be individualized. And I think we need to be thoughtful and careful not to overextend these results to younger populations and lower-risk populations in the absence of further studies.
It's a classic case of sort of shared decision-making. You got to sort of choose your benefit and choose your harm and cross your fingers.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly some benefit, and it's an important benefit in terms of reducing mortality. But, you know, you have to treat over 300 people each year with rhythm control to prevent one death, and over 300 to prevent one stroke each year. So, you know, that's not nothing, but it's on the smallish side in terms of benefit. And then you have these drugs that can cause toxicity. They can interact with anticoagulants. You know, there are a lot of things to consider about these drugs, and they actually spent. They had more hospitalizations for heart failure and acute coronary syndrome in that rhythm control group, you know, possibly because of some of these drug effects.
Just having that discussion with an elderly patient, mm-hmm. First of all, it can't be done in a usual 12-minute visit. And second of all, it really can be challenging for lots of patients to understand and weigh these risks and benefits.
And I think it's hard for, you know, cardiologists to just sit there and do nothing. They've got all these tools at their disposal. They believe in the value of these tools. They believe that ablation is right for some people, that we have these antiarrhythmics, let's use them for people. I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I think there is a well-known interventional bias among all physicians. You know, don't just stand there, do something, right? And, you know, sometimes we need a little more of the opposite, and we need to remember that, you know, all of these great tools aren't always the best thing for all of our patients.
You know, as a guy who's getting a little bit older, it is one of the pieces of information, I think, that comes with age and experience. There are some times when it's better to just not do something, and it's really to the patient's advantage. It's not about us being lazy. It's really it's about weighing risks and benefits.
That's right.
We'll talk with you again in a week, Mark. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.